in curved spacetime.
Right. So this is not a strings talk, and this is also not a cosmology talk. It is a talk on quantum field theory in curved spacetime. But the reason I wanted to give this talk here is that I think it has a lot of implications about how to think about quantum field theory quite in general, and in particular quantum field theory with respect to cosmology issues such as the cosmological constant problem. As I think can be seen from the work that I'm saying, but if in case it's a little too subtle and can't be seen, I'll spend the last few minutes of the talk saying what I think should be gleaned from this in terms of what one should take home in the situation in quantum field theory and curved space-time. So what is this recent progress? Well, basically, quantum field theory and curved space-time is now including interacting quantum field theory, at least at a perturbative level, has been formulated in a completely generally covariant manner, which has necessitated the elimination of symmetries and special states and so on from the formulation of the theory, because one just doesn't have access to those things in a general curved space-time. So what I want to do is describe what's been involved in the progress and the nature of the theory. There are a lot of details which, mercifully for both you and me, I'm sure, I will not be going into all of, but all of the details can be found in these papers that I've listed up here, and since this will be posted on the web, you can get access to the references, I guess, at some point. Okay, so first of all, let me define my terminology. So what I mean by quantum field theory and curved space-time, just specifically, is, I guess that's reasonably focused, is the theory of a quantum field that's propagating in some classical curved space-time. I'll assume that classical curved space-time is globally hyperbolic, so it has completely well-defined classical dynamics. Now, in the context of this theory, one can consider back reaction effects by imposing the semi-classical Einstein equation. I am not going to be talking about any of the back reaction effects here. I'm going to exclusively focus on the formulation of the interacting quantum field theory and curved space-time at the perturbative level. I'm also, in this talk, going to, and in any of the work that I've done for that matter as well, restrict attention to a scalar field. That is, for simplicity, presumably all of the analysis would hold for, or similar analysis would hold for all other fields, although it's conceivable with gauge fields, new issues would arise in preserving both the gauge invariance and general covariance. I wouldn't expect that they would, but we haven't looked at that. Okay, so first of all, what's the situation with a free quantum field in curved space-time? How do you formulate that? Well, at sort of the first and probably most major step, it's absolutely straightforward to generalize the theory of a free scalar field to curved space-time. One has fundamental commutation relations between the field, usually written point x and point x prime, and this would be the advanced minus retarded Green's function at x and x prime. I've smeared these in with test functions to make everything well defined. I'll need to do that later, although that, the formula would have been fine without that. Well, in a curved globally hyperbolic space-time, one also has advanced and retarded Green's function, so there's absolutely no problem taking this formula over. But there is a big problem, even in the free quantum field theory, in doing a lot of the other steps that one would normally do in flat space-time. In the absence of time translation symmetry, there's no notion or no preferred notion of a vacuum state. It's not that there isn't any such notion, there's just zillions of them, and none of them seems particularly preferred. In the presence of, if you happen to have a space-time that does have a time translation symmetry, there will be a naturally defined vacuum state there. And going along with the lack of a vacuum state, at least in the non-time translation invariant case, there's no natural particle interpretation of the theory. But the situation is actually considerably worse than that, because it's not just a question of there's no natural way of labeling which state is the vacuum state and which state are particle states. But in fact, there are many in general, in a general space-time again, there'll be many unitarily inequivalent representations of these canonical commutation relations, and it's not obvious which one you should choose as your Hilbert space then representation of the theory. Furthermore, if you want to work with S matrices, well, of course, whether you can even define in-states and out-states in a natural way will depend on the asymptotics of the space-time. And even if the asymptotics are such that you can define in-states and out-states, there's no reason why they need belong to the same unitary equivalence class of representations, in which case the S matrix, even though you could define it in that case, won't exist. But in fact, there's a very simple and elegant formulation, resolution, of all these difficulties, which is just to go to the algebraic formulation of the theory and to make physical predictions in terms of the field observables and, of course, possibly their couplings to detecting type external devices. So in fact, the formulation from this point of view of the quantum field theory of a linear quantum field in curved space-time is incredibly simple. I mean, so simple that the hardest thing to do is to figure out where the actual work you have to do is to do anything. The idea is that one is going to construct an algebra of field observables. Of course, the first step, which was going to come up as a major factor shortly, but I've already mentioned it, is that it isn't going to make any sense to define fields at a point. One has to smear them. In other words, fields are distributions. Taking that into account, one constructs an algebra generated by these fields by just looking, and you can do so by the following trivially simple procedure, namely, write down all formal expressions involving the field and its star, and then impose the following relations, which are just linearity of the field, the meaning of this star operation, which is basically saying that phi is really secretly self-adjoint, the wave equation on the field, which in distributional form is written this way, and then these canonical commutation relations that I've already written down. If you take this free algebra and factor it by these relations, you get an algebra, and that's going to be the quantum field algebra of the field. Now, what do we do about Hilbert spaces and all that sort of thing? Well, again, in the algebraic view, which is being taken over here, states can be defined just as linear maps from the algebra to the complex numbers, satisfying this positivity condition. Basically, this would be interpreted as the expectation value of the observable A in the state one is in. Well, I'll explain in a second the relationship between this strange notion of states and the usual Hilbert space notion. Well, I'll explain part of it right now. If you have any Hilbert space representation of the theory and you have any vector in that Hilbert space, the operation take the expectation value of the observable in that state will satisfy this condition, will be linear in the observable, and therefore will define a state in the algebraic sense. I'll show you in a second that that's the case. The converse of that is the case as well. That is, every state in the algebraic sense corresponds to some vector in some Hilbert space. What I've written here, I claim, it yields a completely satisfactory theory of a linear quantum field as long as you only restrict to observables in this algebra. In other words, as long as you only restrict to looking at correlation functions of the linear field, you don't look at any nonlinear things in the field and so on. Since this is probably not familiar to many of you, let me just explain this converse. Namely, if we have a state in this algebraic sense, then in fact, Gelfand, Neymark, and Siegel showed a long time ago that you can find some Hilbert space, some representation of the algebra, and some vector in this Hilbert space such that this algebraic state is nothing more than take the expectation value in this vector state. And the proof is actually extremely simple. You basically make a Hilbert space out of the algebra A using the state to define an inner product on it. I won't go through more details. Of course, if I give you two states, omega 1 and omega 2, I can find the corresponding vectors in a Hilbert space, psi 1 and psi 2, but these may very well end up living in unitarily inequivalent representations, in other words, in different Hilbert spaces. Okay, so I said there were no difficulties. In case you were wondering what's the hard part of doing quantum field theory in curved space-time, you'd have to show that some states exist. Otherwise, it's a fairly trivial exercise. And to do that, you'd go through a usual Hilbert space construction and so on. Okay, so where are the divergences that are all over the place in quantum field theory? Where do they go in the free quantum field? Well, there aren't any ultraviolet divergences because I just haven't done anything to encounter them. I'm doing a free field, and I'm refusing to look at nonlinear functions of the field so far. I'm not going to continue to refuse that. There are infrared divergences in the same manner as one encounters in other instances in quantum field theory. But from this point of view, one can see that those are all problems with auxiliary type constructions in the theory, not with the theory itself. For example, if the in and out representations are not unitarily equivalent, you will get an infrared divergence in the calculation of the S matrix. But as I'm arguing that that's not a problem. Well, let me not take the time to do this, but a typical example of an infrared divergence that occurs in free field theory in flat space time is the non-existence of a Poincaré invariant vacuum state in for a 1 plus 1 dimensional massless scalar field. I claim there's no problem with the theory. The algebra exists. There are plenty of states. There just happens not to be a Poincaré invariant state, but that's not a problem for the theory. Okay, now what about everything I've said here has been pretty well understood for a good 10 or 15 years at least. But now what about going beyond the theory of a linear field based on this simple algebra of correlation functions? So first of all, even if you only wanted to do free field theory, there are other observables like stress energy tensor that you might be interested in. That observable is not found in the algebra that I've defined, so you're going to need, at least if you're going to preserve this point of view, an enlarged algebra of observables that will contain objects like the stress energy tensor. Even more significantly, if you want to make sense of nonlinear fields and you want to do perturbative quantum field theory in curved space-time like it's done in textbooks in flat space-time, you're going to, again, need nonlinear functions of the field, and you're also going to need time-ordered products of these things to make sense of the perturbative formula. And again, you're going to need some enlarged algebra of observables that includes these Wick powers and their time-ordered products. So why is this a problem if we have the theory at the linear level? Well, the point I want to emphasize, just so we're on the same page on this at least, is that it all traces back to the fact that you can't make sense of this as an operator or an element of the algebra defined sharply at a space-time point. You can only make sense of the field smeared in with a test function. But if you then try to define the squared field by some direct procedure where you smear in the correlation function with something that goes to a delta function, you just get divergent results. You need to do some kind of regularization on the 5x, 5y before you do that. Even then, after you've succeeded in defining the Wick powers, if you're trying to define their time-ordered product, well, of course, that's well-defined as a distribution when these points are causally separated, or when you smear them in with functions whose supports are causally separated. But you run into major problems trying to define that when the points are coincident. In fact, the only truly serious problem you run into is to try to define these when all, because you could define it recursively otherwise, when all of the points are simultaneously coincident. So basically, the problem of defining time-ordered products as needed for perturbation theory is the problem of extending this distribution that's known off the total diagonal to the total diagonal. Now, in quantum field theory and flat space time books, this is solved in chapter one by normal ordering. Most of the rest of the quantum field theory books solve this problem by, you know, regularization and renormalization of Feynman diagrams. Okay, well, the main advances that have occurred in recent years have resulted in large measure from the importation of some mathematical techniques that had been developed 30 or so years ago by Hormander into the subject. I don't know why the mathematical techniques are known as microlocal analysis, but that's what they're generally called. And I'm not going to try to do a tutorial on microlocal analysis. I don't even know enough about it to do much of a tutorial. But I wanted to just say a couple of words so you get the idea of what is involved in this, and then I'll describe what some of the recent results have been that have in large measure used these techniques as a technical tool. So what microlocal analysis largely basically is a much more refined way of characterizing the singularities of a distribution. And it proceeds by studying the Fourier transform of the distribution and making use of its properties. So if we have a distribution, I can, like a quantum field, I can localize it around some point by multiplying it by some smooth function of compact support in some arbitrarily small neighborhood of the point. Once I've localized it, I have no problem defining the Fourier transform of the distribution. Well, I can pretend that it's embedded, the region that I'm looking at is embedded in flat space time, then one has to show the results that you get are independent of how you do that embedding. And it follows that even though the distribution itself is not a function, its Fourier transform, if it's of compact support, is always an analytic function of the Fourier transform variable that's in fact polynomially bounded. Now, if the distribution actually corresponds to a smooth function, so it isn't singular at all, then it turns out you can easily show that its Fourier transform, in fact, decays faster than any inverse power of k as k goes to infinity. And I also point out, if the distribution were a smooth function, you have convolution formulas like this in terms of Fourier transform to define things like the square of the field. Okay, but now what about if this is not a smooth function? Well, the idea is that you can look after you've suitably localized the function, the distribution about point x, you can look at its the decay of its Fourier transform as a function of direction. And if you happen to find a direction where the Fourier transform of the distribution decays rapidly, like a smooth function, then you call that a non-singular direction of the distribution at point x. This is kind of a momentum space direction k where it's non-singular. The wavefront set of the distribution is then defined to be the points in position and momentum space where the distribution is singular. Now, the point is that in something like this convolution formula, if a singular direction always meets a non-singular direction, this formula makes perfect sense, and you can define the square of the distribution straightforwardly, even though it wouldn't have been obvious how to do that in position space. Okay, so what's happened in this progress? Well, it's been known for a long time that states whose singularity structure has this Hadamard divergence behavior in terms of blowing up in terms of squared geodesic distance between the points, that those states clearly were going to play an important role in regularization of the quantum field and so on. Radzikowski realized that this actually very complicated to state Hadamard condition on states is equivalent to an extremely simple statement about the wavefront set of this distribution. That enabled Brunetti, Freidenhagen, and Kohler to give a construction of this desired enlarged algebra of observables that would include all these things like Wick powers and their time-ordered products that are needed to do the perturbation theory. And their construction was as follows. There are lots of vacuum states of the free field, but choose any Hadamard vacuum state. There's lots of Hadamard vacuum states. Look at the normal ordered correlation functions. Look at the wavefront set of this distribution. It turns out its properties are such that you can smear this in with the delta function. And doing that allows you to define a notion of the normal ordered phi to the n as an operator valued distribution on this Hilbert space. If you look at the algebra of the operators that you get thereby, you get the algebra is independent of what choice of vacuum state you made. So as an abstract algebra, which can also be defined directly, but a little more difficult to describe, that gives an enlarged algebra of observables. That leaves open a major question, though, which is this normal ordered phi to the n depends on the choice of state. It's clearly not the true phi to the n, which is what we want to define. And similarly, if we try to use this to define time-ordered products, that's not what we want. There's an additional condition that needs to be imposed that is not stated in this analysis. And that additional condition is the general covariance of the quantum fields that one wants to define, like stress energy tensor or phi squared or any of these other Wick powers and time-ordered products. So to explain what this general covariance condition is, the first thing to bear in mind is we're not trying to define quantum field theory on one space-time. There'd be a lot of ambiguity in doing that. We're trying to define quantum field theory on all space-times, at least all globally hyperbolic space-times, simultaneously. Now, different globally hyperbolic space-times will, of course, have completely different algebras of observables, because the algebra of observables very much depends on the metric. It comes into the advanced minus retarded propagators and other things in the construction of the algebra. But one can have the following situation. You might have a situation where one of your space-times, or part thereof, is embedded in a region of some other space-time. If you do that, the algebra of observables that you have over here is naturally identified as an algebra with the algebra of observables that you have over here. The general covariance requirement on phi squared or stress energy, whatever fields you want to define, is that the field that you call, let's say, phi squared over here should be carried by this corresponding algebra isomorphism to the field that you called phi squared here. If you restrict this condition to flat space-time, flat space-time can get embedded into itself by a Poincaré transformation, and this condition will basically reduce to Poincaré invariance of the field. So even in flat space-time, this condition of the definition of the field contains a lot of information. But in curved space-time, it now restricts severely the definition of powers of a quantum field and their time-ordered products and so on. So the approach that Stefan Hollins and I took then to analyzing the problem is to take a kind of axiomatic approach. We have an algebra of observables now. We're trying to figure out what element of this algebra has the right to be called, let's say, phi to the n, just as a specific example of a Wick power. And there are a whole list of properties that one can write down, so I've written them down here. Prominent is that this should be a local and covariant field, and a second extremely important property is it should satisfy the commutation relation with the linear field that naively it ought to be satisfying. This is just the condition that it be a real field, and then I think I won't, in the view of time, go through the other condition. This is one that says that the definition of the field should vary smoothly and or analytically under smoother and or analytic variations of the metric. And then this is just a scaling behavior that allows for anomalous scaling, just because if you didn't allow for that, you'd have no solutions to the axioms. And you can write down a similar but somewhat more complicated axioms for time-ordered products. This is the statement that these Hadamard states give smooth expectation values for these fields. For the time-ordered product, you have a much more complicated statement of what singularities you get when you take the expectation value of the time-ordered products, and there are additional causal factorization conditions and a condition that would correspond formally to unitarity of an S matrix if you were calculating an S matrix. Okay, it's not hard to show that these axioms uniquely determine the definition of Wick powers up to a finite number of parameters that correspond basically to couplings to curvature local curvature ambiguities, is I guess what I should say. Interestingly, I mean, in curved space-time, the problem of regularizing the Wick powers and renormalizing the time-ordered products really become on much more of a comparable footing. In flat space-time, there's no ambiguity at all in the definition of Wick powers. Normal ordering is the answer. In curved space-time, there's renormalization group flow in these quantities, and there is finite parameter ambiguity in their definition. But basically, if you want to investigate the uniqueness of the definition of phi squared, you start with the commutation relation, which shows that in fact phi squared is unique up to a multiple of the identity, because anything that commutes with the free field one can show in the algebra has to be a multiple of the identity. Then the local covariance condition tell you that it depends locally on the space-time geometry. The continuity, the analyticity, and the scaling conditions then tell you it can only be a multiple of scalar curvature. And then one can inductively go from there. And there's a much more complicated argument for time-ordered products that I won't even attempt to sketch here. But if you look at the resulting ambiguities you get in the definition of the interacting quantum field, when you go through the construction of that, you find that that corresponds precisely, as you might have expected from flat space-time, to adding counterterms to the Lagrangian, though these counterterms now can include curvature couplings. Well, that's the uniqueness. What about existence? In fact, it's not hard to show existence of a prescription for defining these Wick powers that satisfies the whole list of axioms that I have. The prescription involves regularizing the two-point function by subtracting off some locally constructed distribution that has the same Hadamard singularity type as this had, to get a non-singular quantity that you can then take the coincidence limit of. And I've done it here for phi squared, but there's a combinatorical generalization of that to arbitrary Wick powers. What I want to emphasize is that it's crucial that in order to have a covariantly defined field, that what you subtract off be something that is locally and covariantly constructed. You cannot, in curved space-time, I'll return to this point at the end, do the regularization correctly by subtracting off some vacuum expectation value. Okay, I won't even attempt to sketch the argument for existence of time-ordered products, which is basically showing that you can renormalize all Feynman diagrams that you write down to define this quantity. The basic idea, though, is because the only problem in the first place is at the total diagonal, one can do a sort of expansion around the total coincidence limit of these points, and one can study the scaling behavior of the quantity that you get with all these points extremely close to each other. And then by doing so, show that the singular behavior really only occurs in a finite number of terms in the scaling expansion. And then each one of those terms, the problem that you have reduces basically to finding a Lorentz invariant extension of the distribution that you'd have in the tangent space. But that's exactly Lorentz invariant in satisfying other problems, but that's just the flat space time renormalization problem viewed in this light. So that means, to summarize what I've said so far, we can define Wick powers, we can define their time-ordered products in this algebra of observables we have for the field. The last thing I have to do to tell you about the theory, though, is what do you do with that? Because I said the theory isn't about particles, it isn't about S matrices. What is the theory about, and what do you compute, and how do you compute it? Well, I claim the theory in this viewpoint can only be viewed as a theory of the interacting quantum field, and what one wants to compute is what this interacting quantum field is. Of course, powers of the field, stress energy of this interacting quantum field, and the algebraic relations that occur for these guys. And one can do so with the machinery that I have as follows. I mean, I've written down phi to the fourth theory as a concrete example, breaking it up into a free and interacting Lagrangian. And as is not uncommon even in flat space time, we start with this lambda turned on and turned off, or more precisely some smooth function of compact support with lambda maybe equal to the value that we want in some middle region here. And that being the case, we can formally define an S matrix for this, truncated or whatever you want to call it, interaction in terms of the time-ordered products that have now been defined up to the renormalization ambiguities that I've stated. And then we can apply this this formula that Bogoliubov wrote down about 50 years ago, I believe, to define the interacting field. I mean, this, of course, formula should just be viewed as a mnemonic for the much more complicated looking perturbation series that you would get for this interacting field. Now, this formula is adjusted so that the interacting field would agree with the free field down here in the past. And a usual thing to do in field theory would be to take a limit as these regions expand out, keeping the field fixed at its in value in the past. If you do that, there's no reason to expect the limit to exist, but you can equally well take the limit keeping the field fixed in this interior region, in which case, rather trivially, it always exists, and that defines then the interacting field, and one can similarly define powers and so on of the interacting field. So at the level of formal perturbation series, then, I claim that is the situation with quantum field theory and curved space time, and that's the recent progress. So now what about these lessons that I claimed are... So this is at least what I take away from this, and I'll be interested to get your reaction on a bunch of these things. So the first thing, which really is evident in the free field situation, is in the interacting field. But I don't think there's any choice, certainly when it comes to quantum field theory and curved space time, to view Hilbert spaces as kind of the fundamental entity that you're building the quantum theory out. In fact, I think it leads to a point of view where Hilbert spaces are really, a very useful auxiliary tool to introduce at various stages, particularly when you're doing some calculations. But the point is that there are, in a general curved space time, there are going to be physically reasonable states that have all of these local observables perfectly well defined that live in different Hilbert spaces, that is, that don't live in the same unitary equivalence classes. Furthermore, as everyone is familiar, but people don't usually bother, talking about it or emphasizing, every Hilbert space contains zillions of completely physically unreasonable states. And I don't, at this point, see any reason to keep all that baggage around. Let the states be the states on the algebra of observables in the algebraic sense. They neither lie in a single Hilbert space, nor do they comprise all of the vectors in a single Hilbert space. Okay, the second thing I want to stand up and pontificate on is my view, which I think should be totally non-controversial, but is probably going to be the most controversial thing I would say, I suspect, is that quantum field theory is really correctly named. It really has to be thought of as a theory of local quantum fields. I don't see any reasonable way of formulating the theory in terms of particles, and even less in terms of S matrices or other things. I mean, obviously, if you happen to be working in a space-time with time translation symmetry, there'll be a natural vacuum state, there'll be a natural notion of particles. It certainly is very useful to introduce that. Even if you're not in a space-time with time translation symmetry, if you're looking on scales that are small compared with the curvature, you can introduce an approximate notion of particles, approximate notion of vacuum. That's all fine. I have no objection to doing that. But in terms of a fundamental formulation of the theory, I don't see how to proceed except by starting with the theory as purely a theory of local quantum fields and then introducing the auxiliary constructions as needed later. The other, or another point that I'd like to emphasize, I mean, these points are not all orthogonal to each other, there's a fair amount of overlap, but there are no preferred vacuum states in a general curved space-time, but that's fine. They don't play any role in the formulation of quantum field theory in curved space-time. In fact, you know, to me at least, a statement like what in this space-time, what vacuum do we choose, you know, has the same ring to me as questions I get teaching, you know, general relativity, you know, when we introduce maybe our first curved space-time, and somebody might ask, well, what, you know, we're supposed to use global inertial coordinates in flat space-time, so what coordinates should we use in this curved space-time? It doesn't matter. A side comment, by the way, that I should make on the alpha vacua is that if you consider this unenlarged algebra of observables on de Sitter space-time, so this is just a side comment I'm throwing in here, then one can show that there's a one-parameter family of de Sitter invariant vacuum states, the one of which is called the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and the others are typically called, well, possibly including the Bunch-Davies vacuum, the alpha vacuum. However, if we go to this enlarged algebra of observables, then none of these alpha vacua except the Bunch-Davies vacua is a state on this enlarged algebra of observables, with the exception of the massless case when there isn't even a Bunch-Davies vacuum. There's absolutely no de Sitter invariant state whatsoever. Again, that's an infrared divergence that's of no consequence whatsoever for the formulation of the theory. There are plenty of other states. There just happen not to be any de Sitter invariant ones. But the side comment I want to make is that these alpha vacua don't exist as states on this enlarged algebra of observables. The essentially last point, I have one more after this, but not a serious one after this, is just repeating somewhat in more detail what I said before. Normal ordering is absolutely not, at a fundamental level, an incorrect renormalization prescription. To get covariant quantum fields, generally covariant quantum fields, one has to do a subtraction, which one can do, as I've indicated, with something that's locally and covariantly constructed. It so happens that in Minkowski space-time, this thing that you'd locally and covariantly construct happens to be the vacuum expectation value of the two-point function, and you can therefore interpret the regularization that you're doing as a vacuum subtraction. But it's actually not very hard to show that it is impossible to choose a vacuum state for every space-time such that in every space-time this what the regularization can be interpreted as vacuum subtraction. You cannot produce local covariant fields that way, and vacuum subtraction is just not the correct prescription. Now, there's a lot said about the cosmological constant problem that I don't really sharply disagree with, but I don't really resonate with. The main thing is that it's not just the stress energy tensor that has this strange behavior that if you try to sum it up, you get ridiculous results, even if you put in the most conservative cutoff that you can imagine. Every nonlinear function, and in couplings or equations of motion for the scalar field, or you have a V prime in there and so on, you get the same behavior as the stress energy tensor. So it, from my point of view, a lot of what is described as a cosmological constant problem is, from my point of view, why is quantum field theory so weird that it only defines fields distributionally and you have to do these strange regularization procedures to define nonlinear functions of the field. There's a second problem, which is what, if there is a non-zero cosmological constant, what set the scale of it? So I don't have answers to either of these questions, and I think they're good questions, but that's certainly the way that I think about the problem. And the last thing before Tom gets the hook is a metaphysical lesson, I think, which is whenever you extend a theory into a new domain, it, I think, leads to some new insights which tend to overthrow prior viewpoints of the theory. And I think the lesson to draw from that is that as we make further progress in the quantum gravity, I'm sure it'll invalidate absolutely everything that I've told you in this talk. Okay, thanks.
Okay, questions?
I guess concerning your last point, the second last point about the cosmological constant, there's something special about T mu nu, and that's the fact that it's, if you evaluate it for a scalar field or for any quantum field, it is equivalent to a free parameter in the Einstein equations, namely the cosmological constant. So I think it is a real problem, independent of the fact that you have weird quantum matter.
Right, but I mean the calculation of it and getting infinity and so on and then even fixing it up. I mean, if you write down the, I don't see a difference with that. Say if you write down the equation of motion of a nonlinear scalar field and you have a V prime in there, if you were to calculate, that term in the equation, of course that's somewhat similar to the stress energy, but anyway, if you were to calculate that term in the equation, you'd get an infinite result similarly, or calculate anything. Now, if you're doing electric currents or something, you can more easily argue that the positive and negative contributions cancel and you should end up with zero. But if you put it in an external electric field, then you wouldn't get any such cancellations, and I think you'd have a similar difficulty. I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything that's really that different, except the way I'm saying it, from what other people say, because I don't know what determines, I don't know how these regularization prescriptions came into existence or who created them or why, so it is pretty mysterious. And certainly if there's a non-zero cosmological constant, there's some scale that I have no idea where it's coming from. But
Bob, the thing that disappointed me about your talk, since you're a relativist, is why you didn't face up to quantizing the metric. And I understand that that's a harder problem, but people, if you try and take the axiomatic approach, it seems to me at this point in time one should address that. But maybe it's premature, but can you imagine a similar approach with an algebra of local observables? What are the observables in general relativity? Isn't this whole approach sort of doomed because are no local observables?
I think this is absolutely doomed in terms of generalizing this to gravity, because the whole, exactly as you say, the whole notion of local observables is totally different.
So why
in
do
a
it?
Situation? I think So why do it? I mean, you know. you mean I should do something that I can't do instead, or something ill-defined, or I don't know.
I saw this morning.
But I mean, I completely agree. I mean, but of course, if I had done that, I wouldn't just be talking at this conference, right?
Does your definition of local quantum field theory include any concept like unitarity?
Yeah, so the unitarity of, I mean, although one isn't at a fundamental level, of course you could, introduce this, one isn't calculating an S matrix. As you saw, or may have seen, an S matrix came into the formula for the interacting quantum field. And a formal unitarity condition was imposed on the definition of the time-ordered products. I didn't state that, and I very briefly alluded to it, but a requirement on the time-ordered products is imposed that at the formal perturbative level would guarantee that the S matrix would be unitary. So the short answer to your question would have been just yes, unitarity is imposed on the S matrix.
Well, since a lot of predictions these days in inflation are made on the basis of some procedure to quantize scalar fields on curved backgrounds, I was wondering if your approach has anything to say on the prescriptions that people use, for instance, to give the initial state of a quantum field at the beginning of inflation.
Right. So, I mean, most of the work is essentially, at least that I'm familiar with, is essentially done with what amounts to free quantum field theory, even if they're actually considering nonlinear quantum fields. So, I mean, if they're starting with states that are not of this Hadamard form, which in some cases they are, I mean, then, you know, that would certainly be in conflict with the approach here, because if one accepts this algebra of observables, one only admits Hadamard states. But then, of course, the breakdown is sort of at the Planck scale in any case, so I don't think that there's any need to accept what, you know, this strict quantum field theory and curved space-time point of view, you know, for analyses at that level. So, I mean, I think I would say that the work that I'm describing doesn't say much or doesn't shed that much light on these issues, although, yeah, I mean, because at the Trans-Planckian regime, I don't see why anybody need accept what I'm saying anyway.
Are there more questions?
Nobody else. Now, I was wondering whether a path integral approach to scalar field quantization in curved space-time could solve some of the issues, or I don't immediately see a problem with that approach.
Well, I mean, even in the starting point, there are states that are, and some choice of states that's implicit in writing down a path integral. I mean, typically some in vacuum and out vacuum, you know, are implicit in that. But in a, you know, in Big Bang cosmology or some model that's much more complicated than that, what is your in vacuum? What is your out vacuum? I mean, it's
boundary condition,
yeah,
on which
right.
fields you integrate.
That's over. Right. So it's hard, sort of hard to get started on that, and it leads into these same issues as how do you choose the vacuum, what Hilbert space do you, and so this approach sidesteps all of that and allows you to choose anyone that you want. So you can do the theory this way. You know, then if you have some additional knowledge and you know what the true vacuum state ought to be in this space-time, and that's the one of physical interest, nobody stops you from choosing that and working with that. But the framework doesn't require you to choose it before you get started. I mean, that's the, you know, the most significant advance, I think.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's thank Bob again.